call the docket.
Ronnie Lee Stone against the Commonwealth of Virginia. James C. Martin, the appellant. Arthur R. Herring, Attorney General. Jamie B. Tyson, Senior Assistant Attorney General, including appellate.
You may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may, of my time for rebuttal. I am James C. Martin of Martin & Martin Law Firm in Danville, Virginia, representing Mr. Ronnie Lee Stone. I briefly represented him in the trial court. He hired a couple of attorneys, and the second one entered pleas of guilty to several cocaine distribution charges and so forth involving firearms. These were all guilty pleas, so the only issue is the sentencing. There's no disagreement on the facts. Our assignment of error is that the mandatory minimum sentencing provisions were improperly applied as to 12 of the 20 years that the trial judge imposed, quote, as a mandatory minimum. We concede that there was a mandatory minimum applicable to the other 8 years. There were two stipulations of fact. For one of them was for a particular offense date, and the other for a group of dates. And one of them had mentioned the firearm, the other one did not. Under the somewhat convoluted statute that the legislature has seen fit to come up with on this, there are mandatory minimums, but there is what's called the safety valve or escape hatch or whatever you want to call it that can let you get out of those. Of course, we know that if we win this case and it goes back to the trial court, we have no assurance that the trial court would not do the same thing as not a mandatory minimum. But since she gave what she thought was a mandatory minimum and not more, then I think Mr. Stone might be quite likely, especially given the guidelines of the case, to get less time. We know that he's going to get...
May I interrupt you and ask you this? Who has the burden of proof on a safety valve, and who has the burden of not persuading the fact finder as to what the difference should be?
As I think the court knows, Justice Kelsey, the Attorney General filed a case recently on that Your Honors had come up with, I believe, on December 20th, which strongly suggests that the appellant or the defendant has the burden of proof. I don't know that it says what the burden of proof is. It is also distinguishable, I think, in that...
Can I interrupt you there? The burden of proof beyond the specific exemption being relied upon by the defendant under the safety valve?
Well, it may be, and I don't know that case involved a different part of the safety valve, whether the defendant had given the Commonwealth all the information. Ours has to do with the gun, whether this was used in connection with the gun.
So who has the burden of proof? What's the point?
Well, I don't think this court has specifically ruled on this subsection, but assuming arguendo that we do have the burden of proof, we don't know what it is, we don't know whether it's a scintilla, we don't know whether, I submit it would not be more than a preponderance. I don't think it matters in this case because all the evidence was stipulated. Everybody agrees on all the evidence.
But the question is the inference from the evidence, not the historic facts, but reasonable inferences. And if your assumption, which you're not conceding, but if your assumption were right and the defendant has the burden of proof, then on those 12 offenses, you'd have to persuade the fact finder that there's a reasonable inference that Mr. Stone did not possess the gun. during those instances?
But 12 years worth of offenses. I believe it's a total of 7 charges, and 3 we're admitting and 4 we're not. But, again, as the court says, with all respect, I don't feel like I can concede that. But, I mean, it's quite likely that we do have the burden of proof. And if I don't think it's more than a preponderance. And I think we have made that burden of proof, not only because the evidence was stipulated, but because there was an addition to the pre-sentence report. Now, it's not in my copy of the pre-sentence report, but it was ruled to be an addition to the pre-sentence report, which was agreed by everybody on page 238 of the appendix, that the defendant had been robbed previously, and that's basically why he had the firearm. Now, was he using it in connection with the offense because the person was a drug dealer? We don't know that. We don't know that he was robbed by a drug dealer. I submit that we can't assume that. But Your Honor's point is well taken. I just think that this is distinguishable from the case that the Attorney General cited. I did not see the words, and if I'm missing them, of course I'll stand corrected, but I don't see the words, "We hold that the burden of proof in each and every one of these safety valve cases is always on the defendant or the appellant." I don't see it saying what the burden of proof is, but we've met it. We've met it by a preponderance, I would say, because of the factors that I have argued specifically. It was in connection, I submit, with it was not in connection with drugs that the firearm was possessed. And we don't know what days the firearm was possessed other than what is said in the stipulations. There's a we cannot assume that. There's all kinds of things that might seem quite likely in the legal system. When I was prosecuting, you're like, okay, we have to dismiss this drunk driving case because you didn't prove that he was driving on a public road. Well, he's just down a little path or in a part of the parking lot that you couldn't possibly get to without going to a public road. So unless he was sitting there for 3 hours or he parachuted from a Zeppelin, he was on a public road. But
right, but why does it matter what day if the evidence is that it was purchased prior to the first undercover cocaine purchase?
Because the only stipulations were, Your Honor, that we're on the specific days that we're saying, and I think the Commonwealth has insinuated at various points that he had it before then, but we don't know. We don't know if it was in connection. I submit it was not in connection because of the passage
of that site. Am I wrong that Stone agreed to the Commonwealth's proffer on that point at the sentencing hearing?
I'm sorry, Justice McClanahan, but are you wrong as well?
I thought Stone, am I wrong about the fact that Stone actually agreed to the Commonwealth's proffer at the sentencing hearing on that point?
That he had the gun on a previous date, and they did agree. They did agree that. I don't remember exactly which date it was. It was not one of the dates that are in the indictments. We don't know if it was there continuously. My sort of off-point about the drunk driving. We don't know things. We can't assume things because he had it there before. Was it there continuously? Did he take it to a shop and bring it back? If it was in connection with drugs, was it in connection with drugs every day? And I submit that it was not shown to be, and in fact proven not to be used in connection.
Counsel, you've made that argument a couple of times that it was not in connection with the drugs. The CAV took the position that you did not argue that point, that your entire point was possession. Were they wrong, or did I misunderstand their opinion, or why are we talking connection?
I submit that it is in, I understood them to be complaining about my assignment of error when they got into that point, and I submit that Your Honors have granted a writ that's specific enough for the court. The court is the one that decides if it's specific or enough. And I submit, we cited the statute both in the petition and in the brief, and I don't know if I used the word connection. I don't know if they're talking about when we argued the writ or when we were in the lower court. I can't sit here and say that I used the word connection physically in every single argument, but it was certainly in the brief, and I submit that it was, therefore, argued, and we are arguing it. We would ask the court to, for the ends of justice, to consider it to be that way, and I think it is that way that we did argue that. So we would just submit that every time there's one of these mandatory minimums, judicial discretion is being partially erased by the legislature, that these things ought to be construed with that in mind, regardless of the burden of proof. There's no question of the facts. There's no question of guilt. We are just asking the court to say that these 12 years were not a mandatory minimum, that would not take away the discretion of the trial court to give a sentence up to that if they thought that it was warranted. But that's what we're asking Your Honors to do at this time. Thank you.
May it please the court, Virginia Tyson for the Commonwealth. The starting point of the analysis in this case is that the General Assembly has determined that a second distribution of certain narcotics, including cocaine, is deserving of a very harsh penalty. In fact, it's 5 to life. And the legislature determined that in order to be sure that some prison time is served, namely 3 years is served, that would be a minimum mandatory sentence. The statute before the court, 18.2-248, is not a penalty enhancement sentence. In fact, it's quite the opposite. You may get life. You must serve 3. Unless you, as the defendant, can bear the burden to satisfy every one of the 5 requirements of the safety valve. And that is by, our argument is by a preponderance of the evidence. I think this court did hold in Hall that the burden of proof on the safety valve is upon the defendant, and I think that it would not be would not make sense that certain components of the safety valve would have a burden on the defendant and other components of the safety valve would not. We also, on brief, relied on a number of federal cases. Of course, the safety valve has been slightly differently, but very close in the federal court for quite some time. They've had the safety valve, and those courts have expressly held that the burden is upon the defendant, and those courts have held that it is by a preponderance of the evidence. And this court should reject the defendant's argument that he is entitled to the safety valve for the first 4 drug distributions.
And don't the federal cases go further and in analogous circumstances say, well, once you possess the firearm in your home and you're having this cash business, et cetera, then that's sufficient to convict. In other words, you don't have to greet the police at the door with a gun or defend your stash of drugs with a gun. It's sufficient that it's in the house and that it could be used for defending the drug.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, the Bolka case, I think, maybe is the most specific case that holds when the weapon is in the home. And McLean, which is also quoted by Herrera, 2 cases that were cited on brief, note that the clandestine placement of a weapon in a home is as dangerous as if it were on the person of the defendant. And so those cases have discussed constructive possession, and of course the Court of Appeals discussed constructive possession a great deal in its opinion.
And we, in a variety of contexts, we've said, I mean, including things like child endangerment and other areas, that drug dealing, it's sort of well known, is an inherently dangerous occupation. Drug dealers certainly know that. They know they're at risk for being robbed of their drugs or their cash. And so when they're armed, there's a logical inference that that is in part to defend their drug dealing activity.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that the trial court in this case really made something of that finding. And it's on page 253 of the joint appendix, where the court concluded that the defendant had not met the requirements for the waiver of a mandatory sentence. And the court noted that the only business he had was selling drugs, and he had this weapon in connection with that business. Now, it's very important that the proffer that was made at the sentencing hearing about this weapon, which is on pages 238 and 239 of the joint appendix, is that the wife of the defendant made the statement that the weapon was purchased 2 months prior to the execution of the search warrant, which was on October 30th, and that it was kept in the home. Now, that's on 238. And then on 239, the court asked if there's any objection to that stipulation from the Commonwealth, and the defendant says no, so there's no objection. This is the stipulated evidence, that the gun was purchased 2 months earlier, it was kept in the home, and all of the sales about which we're arguing today, those four, occurred after the time that the weapon was purchased. And so the weapon's in the home while these drug distributions are going on October 9th, 21st, 26th, and 28th, I believe. And so the defendant did not shoulder the burden to show he didn't possess the firearm during the pertinent time. And the statute doesn't require use. It requires possession. Now, it requires possession in connection with the offense. But I would suggest to this court that issue is not before this court. The Court of Appeals was in footnote 5, pages 338 to 39 of the Joint Appendix, noted that the in connection phrase was not the issue before the court, and the defendant did not assign error to that holding. So,
in connection is not that threatening of a phrase here, because doesn't it really just go to the intent? I mean, if the drug dealer is actually using a weapon during a drug buy, then obviously it's being used. But if he has it in the closet, he's not intending to use it, but his intent was, if I need it, it's there. Why isn't that enough for in connection with?
Oh, Your Honor, it absolutely is. I think the trial court was quite correct in finding that this weapon was possessed in connection with the business of drug dealing.
So if we get into the mens rea of the in-connection possession, it's far attenuated from actual use, which I think is part of the argument that we're being advocated to adopt.
Absolutely. It absolutely is. The statute could have said, as some of the federal use in furtherance of statute say, our statute doesn't say use. It says possession in connection. And that is precisely what I think that McLean and Herrera, the federal cases, were referencing, that where you've got the well-placed weapon in the home or in the room, then that's as dangerous as the person having possession on this person. And so we have that in this instance. Certainly the in connection with was established. It was constructive possession during the pertinent time. And the purpose of the statute is to...
Can you think of a time that it wouldn't be in connection with, but the gun is present in the home? I mean, under your theory?
Well, because all the sales were made at the home, and perhaps you could make an argument that if the gun were left at the home and the sales were made somewhere else, you might have an argument in that instance. But all of the sales here were made actually from the very home where the AK-47 was being housed.
And first off, this is an AK-47. You don't do a lot of rabbit shooting with an AK-47.
No, Your Honor, you don't. And when there is, it was fully loaded and there were extra rounds, it was located in the same place as the drugs and the scales. And, of course, this was a very serious operation. The evidence is there was more than $12,000 seized, 12 vehicles. Almost an ounce of cocaine was seized on the one date, and when you add up the other four, it's almost an ounce as well. So this is a major drug operation, and the AK-47 was there. And if the court looks at the photographs that were introduced into evidence, you will see there is also a toddler involved living in that house, or at least in the house when the search warrant was executed. So this was a very serious operation, and the weapon was possessed in connection with the offense. And the trial court did not err in determining that the burden hadn't been met by the defendant in order for the waiver of the mandatory minimum to apply. And we would encourage this court, and we would ask this court to affirm that judgment. I'm happy to answer any other questions, but if not, we would urge this court to affirm the judgment of the circuit court in this case and the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Mr. Martin, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Please, the court. only one of these five factors, like the recent case in December, which involved another factor, but only one of these factors is in play here. The Commonwealth conceded that. So even if the defense has the burden of proof, I submit if the Commonwealth gets up there and says the gun is the only thing that kicks him out, which is exactly what the Commonwealth's attorney said in this case, then that's what we're here about. I don't think, and I'm not sure if the Attorney General's even arguing this, but I don't think that we are, you know, here on anything but the gun. And the in connection thing, I think, has gotten a little bit confused. We're not arguing, maybe somebody is arguing, but we're not arguing that it has to be in connection for guilt. We don't have a guilt issue in this case. We're arguing that it has to be in connection, that's the issue on the safety valve, and that we have proven that it was not in connection because he was using it to defend his family, as the addendum to the pre-sentence report said.
Why can't that finder just listen to that and say, I'm not persuaded by 51% certainty? Maybe it's true. Arguably, it's a prima facie showing of evidence. A fact finder could have found it at 51% certainty, but why is it irrational for a fact finder to say, I'm just not persuaded?
Well, because I don't think the court went through the process. Like the case in December, I mean, which Your Honors remanded, they're not saying that the judge was wrong. The judge in that case, the trial judge, said, I'm not even considering this because it's a report on the date of sentencing saying that the Commonwealth, that the defendant cooperated with the Commonwealth and told them everything about everything. Your Honor sent it back and said, you have to consider this. I don't think there's any evidence that the trial court judge considered this. She just looked at the mandatory minimum. She said, here's a gun, here's drugs. That would be appropriate in a guilt issue, I submit. I mean, maybe somebody else is arguing in some other case that you have to have it in connection for guilt. We're not arguing that because we don't have a guilt issue. The family had been robbed. Yes, he had children. So it was in connection for guilt, but as far as taking him out of the safety valve, or rather, we don't even have to get into in connection for guilt because that's not an element of it. It comes in for the safety valve, and we have shown that it was not used in connection with it. As far as the 2 months earlier, just briefly to end, I mean, if he had it 2 months earlier, I don't think we can infer that he had it every single day. I mean, people travel around. They have land down here. They go from here to here. I don't think that is a sufficient inference to say that every day after that, that it was used, there was a gun plus drugs or a gun plus drugs and an inference of being in connection with. The only stipulations are with the specific dates that we were involved with. So we would ask the court to remand this court for resentencing on a non-mandatory minimum basis as to those 12 years. Any other questions, I'll be glad to try to entertain them.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The next two cases on the docket are